Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. This is Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik. Thank you for being here with us. RedIce.tv is the website. Please check in frequently for radio shows, videos, our live TV show, news, and more. Well, today our guest is Tom Sunik, who's back on the show with us. He's the author of Against Democracy and Equality, The European New Right. He's also written Homo Americanus, Child of the Postmodern Age. He has a PhD in political science from the University of California, Santa Barbara. Also, the Research and Study Group for European Civilization is kind of another faction, another group that has formed around this line of thinking pertaining to the new right. Welcome back, Tom Sunik. Good to speak with you again.
Well, thank you for your invitation. I appreciate it. And all the best to your colleagues and our listeners.
Very good. Thank you so much for being here. I wanted to speak with you today. There's a number of issues, of course, that have occurred since you were last on the show, not the least the migration crisis, of course. A tremendous amount of pressure has been put on Europe, the infrastructure, the people, and we're going to speak a bit about some of the reactions to this and how things are going to formulate the coming years post-migrant crisis. And it doesn't look like it's going to slow down either, so we'll get into that. But one of the things I wanted to address here in the beginning is pertaining to the new right in Europe, and I guess some of the thoughts that has led in this direction, because we've seen, of course, a tremendous growth of the alternative right or the alt-right movement in America. This has, of course, taken roots in Europe to a certain extent as well. And the school of new right political thought, if you will, has obviously emerged out of the environment of, I'd say, France primarily, late 60s or so. But I thought it would be good to go back a bit and remember some of the tenets and where some of these ideas come from, Tom. And of course, you're very well versed in a lot of these ideas. You've been involved with a lot of the movements, etc. How would you describe to the listener what the going back to the origins of the new right, what that really is?
Mm-hmm. Well, let us first start with some concepts, with the clarification of some concepts. And unfortunately, I need to go a little bit into the etymology of the word the new right and alt-right as well. And after that, we can look a little bit more at the substance and what the ideas are behind, which fuel this quote-unquote alt-right and new right. Now, as far as the new right is concerned, and as you may well remember, I wrote a book about this. This was my doctoral dissertation back in '88 in California, the University of California. The new right, this is now the term that is associated with Alain de Benoist, to some extent, of course, with myself and with other people, especially in France, but to some extent also in Germany and in England as well. However, keep in mind that the term the new right was not launched by Alain de Benoist, or for that matter by myself. It was basically launched, crafted by the hostile media in the late 70s.
Right.
It had a somewhat pejorative meaning at that time, and it still does have a pejorative meaning and pejorative significance, rather, because this is not certainly the term I would love to use. Well, I have to use it one way or another, because being now tossed into this category of the new right, I have to use it one way or another. Although I myself, including Alain de Benoist, we have been constantly harping on this issue. No, this is not the right term, because we are neither left, we are neither nor on the right side. We are in between in our way. So please, folks, do avoid using this term, the new right. So we basically have to use this new right by default, if you wish. Having said that, I certainly need to commend my colleague, by the way, Richard Spencer. I think this is a very appropriate expression, the very appropriate denomination alt-right, because it sounds less pejorative, it sounds more neutral, so it's a better weapon, if I can put it that way, somewhat metaphorically, against our detractors and our enemies. And I presume also this is going to gather momentum also in Europe, because as you certainly know, Richard Spencer and the alt-right as a phenomenon has hit the news, or not just in the States, but also in England and here in France and in Eastern Europe as well. Yeah. Everybody talks now about the alt-right. And I indeed think this is a very appropriate term now for denoting, for depicting not just a political movement, but also a cultural movement, an activist movement, and also a dissident, a non-conformist movement. This is something we need to underline, not just for our listeners, but also to the fake media, to the main media. We have to tell them we are a non-conformist movement. We are not necessarily abiding by what you think we are on the right wing, because those words now, after the Cold War has been over for 25 years now, have absolutely no more meaning. I mean, I just don't want to talk about myself, but generally speaking, we people in Europe and in the United States, we are just as much opposed against communism as we are against liberalism. So this certainly does not qualify us to be categorized or qualified as some right-wingers, because as I'm sure you will agree with me, the term right-winger has a very pejorative and very negative connotation. So we can start with that, and I certainly like talking about those semantic problems, because everything is semantics.
Yeah, definitely. I understand that. And of course, there's many components and tenets, which is very anti, you know, commercialism. It's anti the kind of materialism that we've seen come out of liberalism, etc. And I think most people on the left would consider, you know, commercialism or capitalism to be, you know, more on the right, if you will. And these, you know, these words, of course, they hold certain historically certain meaning. I think there's some truth, of course, to say that the line of thought that we're discussing weighs heavier on the right side of politics than maybe than on the left. But what do you, what would you say are some of the of how this got started? You said that there was basically a hostile press that put this term on a new line of thinkers that arose out of Europe with Delaine de Benoist, as you mentioned, and some others. What were some of the ideas at that time that was discussed? What were some of the central points at that point?
Well, okay, so now let's try to just backpedal a little bit back into the 70s and early 80s, when everybody in France back then was talking about the new right. And of course, there was this inevitable gnomon of fascism, neo-fascism, and what have you. I mean, this is a standard vocabulary, the standard lexicon used by the hostile media, and it's still being used that fashion. So even as I said earlier, this expression, the new right, has still a rather negative connotation. Now, I just need to tell you one thing, which is quite important. I also think this is a rather ambiguous expression, because again, in the United States of America, just a little bit of grammar, we need to backpedal a little bit into neoconservatives as well. I'm sure you realize that most of our American listeners and who are in the States, of course, they realize that the new right is also an expression often used in depicting the neocons. And I've seen it many, many times in commentary, in Forward Journal back in the 80s and 90s. So I definitely, if I can just make my own summary, I certainly prefer the term alt-right. Now, as far as the ideas are concerned, look, this is something on a purely psychological level. I guess I need to frame it in a decent, in a comprehensible fashion. On a purely psychological level, whatever I say, however many disclaimers I may make that I'm not on the right side, that I'm not on the left side, my enemies, my detractors, or the mainstream media now, this including the Huffington Post, who do here and there, they quote me sometimes in a negative sort of context. They will always call us with those standards words like white supremacists or white nationalists or anti-Semites. This is a standard word that they're tossing around in order to discredit us. Now, from the psychological level, if those people, of course, they don't have solid arguments, and since they don't have solid arguments, then they use those shut up words like anti-Semites, white nationalists, or white supremacists. These are very, very bad words. And my opinion is, in fact, this is what I'm also suggesting to some of your listeners, the more you try to make those disclaimers, the more you defend yourself, the less success you will have.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
So we just have to put up with that, yeah, and just show by our deeds, by our actions, by our literature, by our massive amount of, our heritage, by our knowledge, by our prominent thinkers and scholars, that we are simply something unique and something really, something which is not which does not abide with this political correct, with this political correct and self-censored monologues of the mainstream media.
You know, one of the things I like then with the alternative right or alt-right, name is that it also kind of hinges a little bit on some of the other kind of alternative movements that we've seen, not the least with the alternative news media that actually has risen up in the last few years, which has been tremendously successful. And I think we've seen just actually in the last few months now, Tom, a kind of a pushback against this. I'm reminded of things such as not only, of course, Twitter censoring people, but Google has started to kind of implement an algorithm for accuracy's sake. And Facebook has done the same. They ask the reader to judge the story as true or false. It goes right in line with these claims of so-called fake news that we see as an attempt, I think, by the liberal world order to fight back against a rising opposition to their hegemony of ideas. And this is a pushback. And I would liken that, you know, a lot of these thoughts are connected with also the alternative news medium that has risen up with the internet, that there's so many cells and different kind of factions to this that are fighting back. I don't know if we could call them all alt-right, of course, but it's all an expression of a very anti-establishment line of thinking, which I think has been actually very, very successful so far. What would you say to that?
Absolutely. Well, as I said earlier, like alt-right, I certainly would find another synonym, and namely the non-conformist right, if I could put it that way. And one thing we also have to single out, which I think is very, very important, is that namely this mainstream media, or let's call it the system media, I call it the Lügenpresse, as the Germans call it, or the fecal press, not just the fake press, the fake media, but the fecal media as well. They've discredited themselves. All those folks, their correspondents, those scribes, the journals, they don't want to admit it in public, but the very fact, and we have it now, we have seen it recently in the States with the Trump phenomenon, that despite this huge amount of politically correct media reports against Trump, very few people have actually actually paid attention to it. As you said very well, we are now resorting to alternative media. So, okay, next to alt-right, we also have alternative media, including the Red Ice as well, you know, which certainly function as a good source of information, and not just information, but also a source of critical thought. And I guess this is something we need to bank on. This is something we have to rely upon. And again, the media, the mainstream media, be it in Stockholm or be it here in Croatia, or for that matter, be it in Washington, D.C., is panicky. They're not happy about this because they can no longer mold the opinion of the populace, including the younger people especially, as they've been doing over the last 70 years, since 1945. Again, we could now backpedal again and basically argue. I don't want to sound too bombastic with some of my expressions, but basically what we are witnessing is another form of warfare, which actually didn't stop in 1945. It's just continuing, of course, by using different methods and different means. And this is exactly, we're witnessing this on a daily basis, as I said, not just in the DC, but also here in Croatia.
Yeah, it's a cultural war. It's an information war. I think a lot of things have actually crystallized post so-called migration crisis, when the borders were totally opened and the signal was sent for all these people from the Middle East, North Africa, even Central Asia to come to Europe, and we've seen a tremendous amount of mounting of problem in the wake of this, of course, Tom, which has been tremendously dramatic. It's been tremendously painful, and it's saddened me to see all this. At the same time, we've seen a kind of a realization on people's parts, which I never knew or never expected, to kind of rise up against these kinds of issues. They previously were very refrained to address these kinds of issues or didn't think much of it. Many people started to realize that it was almost like that this was intentional somehow, that it was meant that Europe was to be flooded by all these foreigners and incompatible cultures, and the problems that we've seen has caused a lot of people to wake up. So there is some good, if you will, with such a negative event. But how do you view the migrant crisis and how this have changed the environment? I think it's responsible, highly responsible for having a lot of people coming over to our side, if you will. What do you think?
Well, that's a good point. You made a very good point by stating that every cloud has a silver lining. You know, like indeed, I'm very happy to admit that. Thanks, if I can put it somewhat ironically, or sarcastically rather, I'm sorry, that thanks to this this huge floods of non-European, let's call them not migrants, let's call them invaders, coming to Europe, especially over this route, the Balkan route, and then across the Mediterranean basin as well, people, even apolitical whites, even apolitical Europeans, regardless whether they come from Corsica or from Flanders or from Sweden in Göteborg or in wherever, let alone Frankfurt or in Marseille, which is one third Arab populated, Muslim populated.
Really?
Now they're beginning to wake up, you know, the folks, even folks who never paid any attention, who don't read at all, if you want to put it that way, just realize that they are physically being threatened, that their jobs and that their security is not the same as it used to be. And look at the irony of history that now many of those Pegida folks in Germany, I don't know if you guys noticed back there in the States or in Stockholm, wherever you may be now at this stage, they had those big billboards and those big posters with signs on it and with words like, Gorbachev, come and save us from capitalism and from migration. In other words, now they want to roll back all those non-communist days and years and return back to Eastern Europe when it was safe and sound, because at least it was, the irony of history, it was protected by communist tanks against refugees. Yeah. So this is another irony of history. And I guess the good point, let me put it somewhat on the optimistic level, the good point of this migrations, of this floods, of this non-European floods into Europe, is that people are waking up. People are waking up, young folks are waking up, they realize on a purely logistical level, let's forget now about the ideology of somebody's fascist or right, whatever those words may mean now, they realize that they are no longer the same, that their security is threatened, that their transportation doesn't work the same way, and that they're getting more and more distrustful of each other. So I guess, as I said, it might morph into a positive situation for all of us. And as I said earlier, every cloud has a silver lining. And again, the good point I wanted to make this at the beginning, folks, let us not despair. I don't want to sound now like a Bible preacher. There is always, history is always open, you know. Like, let me put it that way, like 30 years ago, I was still in the States, nobody could predict that the communism would fall apart, that the Berlin Wall would fall apart in 88, okay? But it did. So again, with a little bit of courage, with a little bit of bravery on our side, we could certainly push the course of history in our direction. I don't want to now, we'll talk about this later on, but I'm positive about this whole issue about migration, regardless of the fact that at the present this is causing a great deal of problems. Now, one other thing I need to say, and I'm sure you will agree with you, and most of your readers and listeners will agree with me. Look, we knew that. I mean, I knew that. I mean, I knew that multiculturalism could not function. There are lots of books about this. There are books very well written, including myself. I wrote quite a few of essays and a book also on this failure of multiculturalism. We knew that 30, 40 years ago, look, that this multiculturalism has to lead inevitably to tensions and possibly civil wars. Look at ex-Yugoslavia, of course, in a somewhat different level. It was a country, it was put together back in 45, you know. It was a mishmash country. Nobody even consulted different constituent peoples whether they wanted to live together or not. And it ended up in what? In a terrible civil war.
Yeah, that's right. So again,
imagine what might happen tomorrow in Göteborg or in Frankfurt.
Oh, it's already happening. Look at it.
This is low intensity conflict going on. And I'm sure there are people in the system. I'm sure pretty much there are people in the system in Sweden itself, regardless of those sellouts. We're not going to now use those bad words against them. Of course, they're mostly they're sellouts. They make good monies. They live in good quarters. They live in posh neighborhoods, what they call the quarters. The French call it quarters. They live in white posh neighborhoods. They send their kids to good Catholic schools or whatever. But they are aware of the fact on a purely logistical level. Let's leave aside their ideological now frame. On a purely logistical level, it cannot function. Look at South Africa. It's falling apart. Nobody's is talking about this in the open. Look at ex-Yugoslavia I mentioned. Look at the balkanization of the United States of America. I noticed that the balkanization of the United States in the early 80s when I lived in southern LA. You know, look, you notice that people are distrustful of each other. So again, this is a very heavy issue and one I'm scared of, you look. And we got to address this issue separately. I don't want to now blame the Muslims or blame the Arabs or blame the whatever blacks or the Asians. Of course, this is the first, how do I say, gut reaction. You don't like people who don't belong to a tribe. You don't like that lingo. You don't like the accents. Yeah, I mean, they just don't belong here. But you got to ask yourself a question. Who brought them here in the first place? Who is actually providing the terrain, the psychological and the ideological terrain to bring them over here? Who is actually promising them this la-la land, which is never going to materialize for those Ahmeds or whatever their name may be and who are coming out from all parts of Asia and Africa? To what do you expect them to wipe the rears of some old ladies in some Catholic senior citizen home back in Frankfurt? Do you expect them to go and get them to work? I mean, look, I don't want to sound vulgar, but you understand the point.
Sure.
Those folks, they're just from different culture. This is a different mindset. This is a different gene pool. And I'm sure there are many, many people, and this is what hurts me most, and I really get emotional when I talk about it. Those bunch of liars, not just in the European Union, but also sitting in the, well, what is the Swedish word for the for Swedish parliament, or whatever, and folks, whatever you call them, or the Bundesrat in Germany.
Yeah, they're aware of that. Yeah.
Yes. Privately, those, you know, I can tell you now, as I used to be a former Croatian diplomat, I can tell you what diplomats tell me in private and what they tell me in public. It's entirely two different things.
Yeah.
So don't, folks, don't believe a word what they are saying, especially what this mainstream media is all about. It's big, big, I hate to say it, mendacity. It's a liberal mendacity, and this mendacity has been going on since 1945. Now, one privilege I had back in communist Yugoslavia, where I grew up before I moved to the States, was that we could realize those. We knew that those folks were con men, those apparatchiks, those bureaucrats. We knew that they were liars because they didn't believe themselves into a single word of what they were saying on all wavelengths in communist Yugoslavia. But the problem is now you have the same thing back in Sweden and back in Germany, or for that matter, in the United States of America, where those media, and I'm sure even folks from the Huffington Post, I know some of them, they just have to, how can I say, regurgitate all those fancy words of equality, of egalitarianism, of economism, and they don't even believe in that. They believe as long as they get paid for it, you see. So they are watchdogs of the system. I'm sorry, I sort of got a little bit sidetracked, but I just need to express that, you know. So you don't expect those people. We're talking about the replacement of the big replacement of the people, okay?
Yeah.
Now imagine 1 million people have already, only in last year, but don't keep in mind that they were already 7 million non-European people in Western Germany prior to this arrival.
Yeah.
And notice that. Now this salami tactics stopped. Now, thanks God, we see this, what it really means, this replacement of the people. It's actually, how can I say, it's a suicide of Europe. And this is something what I'm afraid of. Again, we can focus that, and I'll let you ask me a question on that. Do not blame the Arabs or the Muslims, of course. Those folks, of course, we know that they don't belong to our tribe. Yeah. But you have to blame, we have to actually castigate, we have to actually accuse and hold responsible the white decadent elites, the traitors, if you wish, who are basically conducting suicidal policies against all European peoples, not just against the German people, but also all against all European peoples, including, of course, white people in the United States of America.
And also, of course, those who have nestled their way into our cultural framework and our moral framework, who have changed our attitudes, who have, you know, designed it with the media, with the cultural dialogue and the framework in such a way that many of these politicians have arisen to the position that they have. And now I think many of them morally think that they're doing the right thing. Just look at this example of Marina Ladenburg, who was murdered in Germany. I mean, her father was a legal advisor to the European Commission in Brussels. He was working on all kinds of, ironically, of course, he was helping refugees. And she was also, I think, on her spare time doing these kinds of things. And this is far from being an isolated case, despite what Merkel said. You know, it was actually just the other day, it was revealed that about 1,576 sex crimes had occurred in Germany in 2015. I frankly think it's higher than that, but these are just some of the officials numbers coming out. And these are what happens when you're forcing together, as you say, incompatible cultures. I mean, I'm not as easily. I understand what you're saying, that we just, you know, we can't be mindless about this. We need to question who's done this to us. At the same time, I do feel these people have a behavior that they must have held be responsible for as well, right? I mean, they can't just be let off the hook with this kind of criminal behavior, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Now, you have addressed a very serious issue here, and I guess I would probably need the whole semester to cover all nooks and crannies especially of the German case. Now, let's keep in mind, whether we like it or not, Germany is the center of Europe. So when we talk about the European Union, when we talk about Europe, the first thing that comes to my mind is Germany. Germany is the center, it's the locomotive of Europe, whether it likes it or not. Now, Germany is certainly a very specific case. Now, again, I wrote about this extensively, and some of my colleagues, including Alain de Benoist, they wrote about this in French. I did some translations of it. Now, Germany is a special case because, look, keep in mind that in order to understand the mindset of the establishment, of the political establishment in Germany, including many of those, what they call them, Hofhistoriker, rather what they call the court historians and court intellectuals of the system, including their mainstream press, like the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, and then Frankfurter Rundschau, and whatever, the Spiegel magazine. Look, let's try to put things a little bit in a historical perspective. I don't want to bother your folks who are listening to us very much, but we need to put things always in perspective if we want to understand the suicidal, neurotic relationship of the German political class. It all goes back to 1945. I'm sure you understand what happened there. We are not going to go into historiography. We don't have much time for that. But do keep in mind that Germany was literally bombed into the Stone Age. And I'm sure most of our colleagues now by now know that in the United States of America. And to a large extent, France was also bombed. Oh, anyway, in Central Europe and so on. And of course, Germany, whether it likes it, whether we want to admit it or not, is still a quote-unquote, let me put it diplomatically, it doesn't have a full-fledged sovereignty as other quote-unquote sovereign countries in the European Union. It certainly doesn't have as much sovereignty as Russia. And of course, most of the German politicians, excluding some marginal figures like from the NPD or Alternative for Germany, Alternative für Deutschland, so on and so forth, most of those folks are just valiant servants of the system which was set up, which was established literally on the ruins of Germany in 1945. Hence the reason that they have to behave in such a, from our perspective, when you observe things from Sweden, when I observe things from Croatia, where people might be a little bit more proud, especially from Germany, like if you consider the Trump phenomenon, when we look at the German, servile it's a mimicry, it's a political mimicry. Germany doesn't have much luxury to pursue a sovereign policy, sovereign foreign policy, including its sovereign, including to reboot, its own identity, because it immediately gets tagged as a Nazi country. They have the German have the expression Nazi-Keule, the Nazi stick. Whenever somebody raises his voice, like folks from the NPD or FDA, AFD, whenever they raise a voice against foreign non-European migrations, whenever they say something which goes to the benefit of the German people, they're immediately smeared the next day by not just by liberal and leftist journalists in Germany, but all over the world as a neo-Nazi country tempted by some Nazi demons. This is a standard rhetoric you hear, especially if you read Haaretz and if you read the Jerusalem Post, including if you read the New York Times and so on and so forth. So keep in mind this sense I call it the false victimology of Germany. I'm just looking for a nice word in anthropology. The sense of sin is constantly plaguing the German politicians. If I can just illustrate it, okay, here comes another idea. The German president, Gauck, it's just a ceremonial figure, it's not a big figure nonetheless. When he traveled, last year he was in Jerusalem, he said twice, literally, I'm probably not misquoting him, that the German identity depends on the survival of Israel.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
So this gives you an idea to what extent this country is submitted to foreign ukases, to foreign whims. And of course, the German political elites have to behave in such a fashion. I'm sure Madame Merkel is not that stupid, Frau Merkel. She knows certain things. We can now make jokes about her being unmarried, having no kids, and so on, just trying to sort of mimic this liberal paradigm, as they call it, which was set up after the Nuremberg trials in 45, 46, 47. But she knows certain things. Like she said the other week, last week, there was a CDU Congress in Munich, I think, yes, and she said, help me, Hilfe, Hilfe. She's also a poor woman, a castrated woman, if I can put it that way, you know, metaphorically speaking. And just like all of the German political class, she has been neuroticized so deeply, so profoundly, that what we are basically observing in Germany is just the regular outcome of this, I'll use the right word, brainwashing that the German people and the German elites have been subjected to over the last 45 years, let alone, and we could now talk about this for another semester, about the German criminal code, but penal code, which is incredibly harsh, you know, which many Americans, some of my friends in America can't even conceive how harsh it is. For even the minor jokes, if you crack a joke against a Turkish Gastarbeiter, a worker or something, you can land in prison, you know. You can have some serious things. You can have, you know, your career can be ruined. You know, To some extent, I also experienced that, but it was far from some of my colleagues who actually served long prison sentences just for doing some research, you know. So again, if you consider all those things, now I mentioned at the beginning Germany, but to a large extent, what happens in Germany on a psychological, on the media level, on the academic level, whatever happens in Berlin, the next day spills over into Eastern Europe and, of course, into Western Europe. France is also a country, you know, we could now debate about this, how tough it is. It also has very strict laws. Now, France, in terms of, nobody actually knows what the right profile of the foreign migration is in France. Some of my colleagues, I mean, I'm talking about serious people, tell me that there is about 20% of the French citizens, you know, who are of non-European origin. Well, it's hard to say.
Yeah.
Definitely, look, there is about 7 or 8 million Muslims there. I guess there might be the figure might be higher even. I can't even say that. Now again, if I can just backpedal, and there are so many issues I would like you to discuss here, but we don't have much time for it. Like as of 2 years ago, the French Parliament, Assemblée Nationale, what they call it, the French Parliament dismissed. Actually, they stroke away, they brushed away this expression, la race, the race. So from now on, you don't use, not that you are not allowed, but you are not supposed to use in your scholarly or your official treatises or your scripts or whatever you want to call it, the word race, because according to the French legislation, race no longer exists.
Same in Sweden. They did the same,
same
last year.
Yep. So again, you can't keep a track of all those newcomers, latecomers into France. But definitely, unlike America, now keep in mind, I'm sure you know you live in Sweden for the time being, and we gotta convey this message to our friends in the United States of America, that Europe is in terms of size, it has a half a billion people. I'm talking Western and Central Europe. I'm not talking about Ukraine and Russia. It has a half a billion. 500 million people, and plus it's one third of, in terms of size, it's one third of the United States of America. So you had Texas, you had California, and you multiply it by two or three times. Now, It's a claustrophobic area. It's a claustrophobic entity, the entire Europe. Now, keep in mind, like, I live here in Zagreb. Just to give you an idea to our listeners in the States, I sit on my bike. I'm 5 miles from the Slovenian border. You know, 5 miles, literally. I'm not joking. 5 miles from the Slovenian border.
Yeah.
And in my car, I can make it to Klagenfurt, which is in southern Austria, in an hour and a half, okay? Which is about 100 miles from where I live now, in Zagreb, Croatia.
These are small areas, small countries.
I'm 2 hours from Budapest. And again, look, I'm in. If I drive fast in my car, I avoid driving. I take a tram instead of train. And I guess in Munich, I'm in 5 hours if I speed a little bit in my car. So again, this gives you an idea how small this whole country is and how actually at this stage it is literally being flooded. You know, we're talking to, I mean, look, from the purely logistical level, it doesn't work. It's bound.
That's right. Yep. The infrastructure. There's no places for these people to live. Sweden is a fairly large country compared to some of the other European countries, and still, you know, the infrastructure is not holding up. There's no places to live. They're not building fast enough. I just don't see how are they thinking here? How are they thinking that we're going to get out of this situation?
You have addressed now the most important issue. I don't want to flatter you. And this is the role of ideas, the dominant ideas. Unfortunately, look, we now live in the times of, in the age of mendacities and myths. Back, you know, look, I like reading classics. I'm pretty much an expert on some classics. I would certainly at some different times and different latitudes, I would like to discuss, you know, Sophocles with you and some Homer a little bit. And anyway, what I wanted to tell you that back in the 17th, 18th century, our ancestors here in Europe, they had to abide by certain dogmas. They had to abide by certain myths, because if they didn't, you know, they would go to prison or they would be burnt. They were the Inquisition was, you know, especially in Catholic countries here in Austria, in France, you know, until the period of Enlightenment, until the mid 18th century, the people were burned here, right here in Zagreb. There were quote unquote witches, nice women, you know, nonconformist women who were burned, you know, were killed or massacred, because this was the dogma of the time. Now, let's face it. This dogma of egalitarianism, this dogma of economism, of permanent economic progress. Most people, even not most, but I will say many intelligent people I meet on the regular level, even some high officials here in Zagreb, I'm not going to mention their names. Look, they truly believe in this vernacular. They truly believe in equality. They truly believe in this permanent economic progress. And when I start to debate with them, there's no way. There's no way. No way, Jose. Because they just simply, it's like a religious, it's like a secular dogma. You know, they believe in this permanent economic progress. And you just got to ask them, here's my suggestion. Ask them a question, a very rhetorical question. Where is the end stop of this progress? Because everything that begins but has an end. See, if you talk about an economic progress is liberals often do, then you've got to ask yourself a question. Where does it stop? Because at some point, your income, your whatever, your houses or your cars that you drive, your garbage that you throw back in your backyard, there must be a place, there must be a stop to it. You know, everything has a beginning, everything must come to an end. And then equality. Look, this is something, the most bizarre thing that in our modernity, and I guess there are lots of books about this written, and certainly I'm also discussing that in my book and European New Right, very much in detail, this whole thing about equality. Look around, you see that we are all unequal, but certainly we're not all equal. So we can address this issue as well. I'm sorry if I'm sidetracking you a little bit, if I'm getting a little bit, if I'm getting carried away with some of your questions, but this is a very important issue. It's a matter of life or death. It's no longer, look, you know, I remember 2 years ago we mentioned that. We're talking about multiculturalism. I remember quite vividly about this. It also mentioned ex-Yugoslavia, which we used as a starting point for our discussion, you know, and why multiculturalism didn't work. However, now this time things are much, much more serious. Look, I don't know what's going to happen next day here in Croatia.
Is this what we have to go through, though? I mean, because if democracy or egalitarianism is kind of in itself a secular religion, and it's a belief and it's a faith, if people have faith, as we know, they are convinced that they are in the right. Nothing is going to change. You're not going to change them with arguments. It seems at this point, unfortunately, that the only thing we can do is to let them run the ship into the ground and basically have it capsize. I mean, because I'm not afraid of material. I'm not afraid of the infrastructure of European cities and things like this. I mean, we've lost things in the past. We've rebuilt, we can rebuild things physically and everything else. What I'm concerned about is the culture, the, you know, the human biodiversity, the racial makeup of the different, you know, diverse groups that we have in Europe. Those are the precious things that have to, remain. But so far, I think we're seeing it, Tom, kind of a, we're not seeing an integration process where a lot of these, at least the new people that have come in the last 2 years here during the migrant crisis, they're not like fitting in perfectly in our society, and we are kind of merging with them or whatever. The, what's happening is that the parallel societies are developing, and we're developing conclaves maybe of them versus us. This is, of course, at the end of the day, going to be very detrimental and very dangerous. But if the European elite had some kind of dream of a blended European people or something like Kalergi talked about and these other people, that's not happening, right? That's not actually occurring right now.
Look, my biggest concern is, again, I mentioned earlier, this dominant ideas. The fact of the matter is that the ruling elites, including their, call them scribes, call them their intellectuals, or what the Germans call them court historians and court intellectuals, so well paid and well greased, well lubricated with money. I frequently ask myself, and I do know some of those people. They respect me. They know where I'm coming from here, and I talk to them both on the micro level and the macro level. I wonder sometimes, do they truly believe in what they're saying, or do they do it simply because they're well paid? So there can't be in between. Let me just, I've been studying this issue from the first hand here back in Zagreb in Croatia when Yugoslavia fell apart. Let me just draw a parallel, if I may. And I also wrote about this in some of my books that I wrote in French anyway. And look, when I came from the States here, and I met President Tudjman, and of course I was appointed here as a high diplomat at the Croatian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and I was truly shocked at that time. I just couldn't realize, I couldn't believe my eyes, I couldn't believe my ears, to see so many former communist Yugoslav official, former diplomats, who literally in a matter of seconds, or who in a matter of years, or in months, converted from the Yugoslav, pan-Yugoslav and communist mindset to nationalist mindset, which tells me again how the human nature is fickle. So again, we'll see that shortly, and I also wrote in one of my pieces about this Trump phenomenon. I'm sure we'll be observing that also with many quote-unquote liberal scholars and egalitarian scholars or egalitarian scribes from different journals in the United States of America. If Trump really embeds himself, if he really strengthens his position as the president of the United States of America, and If the cultural environment begins to shift somewhat or becomes less stringent, then I'm not ruling out that he may be experiencing the inflation of brown nosers, if I can put it bluntly. But in other words, he might be also co-opted by the media, which is at this stage very much on the left, there's no question about it, which is very much paleo-Marxist, very much egalitarian, very much multicultural. And I noticed, I gave you again the example of ex-Yugoslavia and how many of those officials, literally all of them, former communist officials, shifted first. The first gear was nationalism, and then afterwards, after 2000, they began to move towards Atlanticism and towards Americanism. It was all the mimicry. So I cannot rule out if some new ideas pop up on the block or if they become popular, even among young students, they will probably be our best supporters. Again, if I can make another parallel, if you allow me, this brings me to 1933. I was just reading the other day some of the memoirs of Goebbels. I'm sure, David Irving brought up this book by Goebbels. It's very interesting. It's not just an archival material. It's good to understand the psychology of the National Socialist big bosses, but also the some of their opponents. It's interesting to note that back in for your info, 1933, just prior to the year in January 33, there was about 1 million, a little bit less, 900,000 members of National Socialist Party. And this number then grew to 8.8 million by late 44. Mm-hmm. An interesting thing is that by 1936 and 37, you had many National Socialist members who exited that party, who left that party, who gave up. Why? Because they disliked those newcomers. They disliked those opportunists. So basically, we got to ask ourselves a question as a summary, and hope for this little talk that I'm having, a long talk. We have to ask ourselves to what extent we are dealing with opportunists, not just among hostile elites and our detractors, but also in our own rank and file. And to what extent are we really dealing with true believers? This is an issue I would like to cover a little bit. True believers, on one hand, in other words, those, if you want to call them starry-eyed multiculturalists who are now raving and ranting about this end of the world in this beautiful la-la land of multiculturalism on the one hand, or simply opportunists. And in my view, it seems to me that most folks are opportunists. They just go there, you know, ubi bene, ubi patria, ibi patria. Wherever it's good, you go where it is. You know, you go where the traffic, okay, as the Americans say. So
yeah,
this is an issue I've been dealing with more from the psychological level. So again, I would, if I may, instead of just talking, I would like to refer you again to my book. And of course, if you folks, you don't have to read myself, but look at the bibliography of my book. I've been very much influenced by Vilfredo Pareto, a great French-Italian scholar, wrote about the circulation of elites. So read him, folks. It was translated into English. It's a good book, very scholarly book. And also Gustave Le Bon, who wrote about the psychology of the masses. So there are lots of other books as he wrote. It's incredibly well, his portrayal of this betrayal of the elites, how in fact the elites move from one side to another. Well, look at the, for instance, even the German, early German, the surviving German elites back in 45, 40, 46, 47, 48, many of them were former National Socialist members. Well, the NATO itself, you know, was actually formed in Germany in 1955, basically with the former German SS officers and so on. Again, I'm probably sidetracking you again, but keep in mind, this is my main point. We have to distinguish between true believers and opportunists. In my view, I think it's opportunists who actually run the show now, and I cannot rule out, provided we have enough intellectual energy, provided we have enough of alt-right, if I can say, spread out all around around Europe, provided we can capture and kidnap, if I can say, kidnap from our enemies this cultural hegemony.
That's
I'm
right.
Pretty much sure we'll have the inflow, a massive influx of people and supporters who will back us up and who will provide a counter-revolution, if I can put it that, provide a terrain for the revival and for the resurrection of Europe, if I can put it somewhat romantically.
Yeah.
Sorry about
that. No, it's fine. I mean, it is a battle of ideas. There is a willpower that needs to be there in place. Maybe we can talk a bit more about that in the second segment. You know, there's many more things I want to get into. This is interesting with the, you know, the psychology of the masses and, you know, why people actually, why they do go along. And the fact is that if we do manage to steer the acceptance of these kinds of issues that we're concerned with into the mainstream and shift the window, if you will, many people are not going to have a problem going along with that, if you will, or discussing the framework of these ideas instead of being so afraid of them as they are now. So that's one item I want to discuss more with you in the second. And then also I want to talk more about the outcome, maybe, you know, of the migrant crisis. If that's going to continue now in spring and summer 2017, we can get into Trump a little bit too and the influence that he might have over, you know, European politics. There's much more to, you know, get into that. So but before we take a break, Tom, just do mention a couple of your titles, because I think it's important that people know what they should pick up if they want to learn more about some of your ideas and some of your work. Is the book Against Democracy and Equality, The European New Right, is that a good start for people, would you say?
Yeah, I think it is. First, I don't want to now brag, and let me be quite frank with you. My books are, to some extent, my ID, my own ID. So I guess my personality, my character can best be transcribed when you read my prose. And I would suggest you my book Against Democracy and Equality, because this was my doctoral dissertation at a very liberal-minded University of California, very leftist-minded folks. So I'm not using some heavy words, and I guess it's very well annotated. It has a huge bibliography. And if you don't feel like reading the book itself, it has about 300 pages, you can just read, you can just go over the bibliography. Plus, it has a nice preface by Paul Gottfried and, of course, by Alain de Benoist himself. And, of course, some of those ideas I trail on later on in my book, Homo Americanus, which was prefaced by my friend Kevin MacDonald. So, again, I certainly don't know, want to folks, you know, bombard you with names and drop names around, but I would suggest you to read definitely Vilfredo Pareto, I mentioned in sociology, Conrad Lorenz in sociobiology, and of course, you know, Carl Schmitt in political and international affairs and in international law, and then of course Oswald Spengler in political philosophy of history, and of course Nietzsche, of course, is a starting point in philosophy. So these are some of the authors, but then here again, this is an important issue too. I hope that now with Trump, and not just with this changing of climate, we'll be able to resurrect our huge heritage from Sweden all the way down to Croatia. From, if you wish, from Ibsen up north, or from Knut Hamsun, if you wish, yeah, from Norway, all the way down to why not, Dante Alighieri, who also writes about the hell in his own fashion. So this is the most important issue, folks, and Henrik, we have to resurrect and popularize in a simple language our huge literary advantage that we have. Unfortunately, this advantage has been completely sidetracked. It has been eclipsed. It has been hidden. It has been forbidden by the media and by the educational system in the East and in the West over the last 70 years. So I hope we will now have a chance to debate it and to theorize more about some of those ideas, which have been not just removed, but they have been also criminalized.
Yeah, exactly. Very important. Okay, there's a couple of links there, folks, that we'll have up on the on our website, of course, to some of Tom's books. He has a Twitter. He has a personal website. We'll add those and some of the other recommendations that he had as well. So definitely check the reference links for this show. But we're going to take a short break here, folks, and then we're going to continue with Tom Sunik in the second segment. And if you do want to join us, do sign up for a membership with us, ladies and gentlemen. Listen to the second hour. And of course, everything that we produce, go to redicemembers.com. That's the best place to go. And as I said, much more to discuss with Tom Sunik in the second segment. So stick around. We will be right back. Thank you for listening.